In a lot of cases, when we think about economic development, it comes at the expense of habitats mm-hmm. or environmental conditions that are important for the survival of species.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. How does a healthy ecosystem benefit humanity? How does the normal functioning of the economy impact our natural habitats and animal populations? And what are the costs and the benefits of conservation? E.L. Frank of the University of Chicago works at the intersection of economics and conservation, and his research asks and attempts to answer these big questions. He joins me now. Eyal, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you for having me.
Eyal, these are big questions, but has economics neglected natural habitats and the animals that live in them?
I think that we have mostly abstracted away from thinking about the natural world as a binding constraint and in a way that can actually have an impact on human well-being. There's been this thinking that there's some divide between how ecosystems function and the role that species play in those ecosystems. And whatever that they're doing, we probably have some human-made substitutes that we can use to replace them if it even comes to having some deterioration in something that we find important. And with that mindset, we paid less attention to the biodiversity crisis, as ecologists call it.
Why do you consider doing research into these topics to be important?
Something that I often quote Michael Greenstone on when he says that just because ecologists don't think about causal inference the same way that we in economics or in the social sciences think about, it doesn't mean that they're wrong. Mm. And they've made a lot of very dire predictions about what will happen to humanity if and when ecosystems collapse and we lose species left and right, and we see these very strong declines in the functioning of ecosystems. They have a very rich theoretical foundation on which they're basing these predictions on. And what I see my contribution is taking them very seriously and trying to test that out using data in the real world to try and quantify what are some of those causal linkages and how big are the magnitudes of these effects and whether their predictions play out in the real world.
At Vox Dev Talks, we focus on the Global South development context. Is the loss of nature particularly acute in these contexts?
Unfortunately, yes. In a similar fashion to a lot of other environmental problems that we have, like climate change, the Global South is experiencing the repercussions of those faster, sooner, and with greater force than in more middle and high income countries.
Let's talk a little bit about some of your work. One thing that strikes me is it must be extremely difficult work to do. We're looking at causal relationships. They're hard enough in mainstream economics to establish. Is it particularly hard when you're doing research into ecosystems?
Definitely so. I think that big challenge always is with finding these empirical settings that we can make the argument that it doesn't get us 100% to a fully randomized controlled trial or a lab experiment where everything is held constant except for that one factor that we're interested in.
Yeah.
But we try our best with finding these rare occurrences where a natural experiment offers a good enough approximation for good as random assignment of different groups, people, villages, and so on into treatment and control status. That's a challenge that I think we face broadly in applied microeconomics, trying to make these connections regardless of the research question. The added challenge that comes with studying biodiversity in ecosystems is also the severe lack of measurement and data. We, in many cases, simply do not have even a snapshot of wildlife populations, let alone data over time that allows us to say how the population has been changing in any granular way or fashion. What I tend to do in my work to try and overcome this challenge is rely on natural experiments, on things that happen out in the world that deliver such a severe blow, such a sharp change to the wildlife population, that even in the absence of any data on the population before or absence of data on the population after, it's enough for me to know that it went down by 50, 80, 90, even more percent during a short time period. And that's how I managed to do without good measurement on wildlife populations in a lot of my research.
A good example of this is your research into the sudden decline of a bat population, which was linked to the use of chemical pest control. We'll find out about that in a minute. But first of all, what was the natural experiment here?
For unknown reasons, it happened in 2006 and it didn't happen before, but this invasive fungus species managed to show up and establish itself in the US. The consensus is that hikers accidentally brought it over from Europe on their boots or backpacks as spores, and just bad luck that it survived the trip and survived that those hikers made it to another cave outside of Albany in New York, and that fungus managed to establish itself there. And from there on, it simply spread throughout bat populations in the Northeast. The importance of this fungus is that it grows on the skin of bat species while they're trying to hibernate during winter. It's away at the top layer of their skin that disturbs them during hibernation. They wake up in the winter. There's almost no food supply available for them to eat. They need to eat more than usual because it's so cold. And by eating away at the top layer of the skin, they also cause severe damages to their wing membranes, so it's harder for them to fly. As a result of all of this, a bat that wakes up prematurely during hibernation tends to not survive until the end of winter. We're talking about, on average, mortality rates well above 70%, with many of the affected caves and locations experiencing nearly complete wipeouts of bat populations, with mortality of 99-100% within just a few years from the arrival of the fungus.
Right, so we have this sudden decline in the bat population. What happens next? What does the data tell you about the impact of this?
So bats have declined. Why is this important for us as social scientists? How is this even remotely connected to human well-being, unless you have some really intrinsic high valuation of bats out in the wild? And the key connection here is that in the US, most of the bat species are insect-eating bats. And a bat will eat about 40% to 150% of their body weight each night in insects. And we're talking about somewhere between 500 million to 1 billion bats estimated in North America. So during the spring and the summer, during the agricultural growing season, when those bats are flying around eating insects, they're eating a lot of insects. That is a lot of biological pest control. Ecologists have argued for years that if and when bat populations were to decline massively, farmers will simply have to compensate by increasing their use of insecticides. And they've done different experiments at more local regional scales to show that bats do provide important biological pest control in agricultural settings. But there remain these big open questions. How will these effects actually propagate over very large regional scales while entire populations of bats start to decline massively? And that's when I heard about this wildlife disease and immediately thought, like, this is one of those rare instances that we get to approximate that experiment of going out and randomly manipulating bat populations at large and meaningful scales, which would not be feasible or ethical to do. But this thing happened because of this invasive species, and we can use that to now test whether that prediction about farmers compensating with insecticides holds up in the data. They took data from the US Geological Survey and different chemical compounds used as pesticides, classified those that are insecticides and those that are not, and looked at whether in the counties that were exposed to this disease called white-nose syndrome, do farmers increase their insecticide use? after the county becomes exposed to white noise syndrome relative to counties that have yet to become exposed to it. So there's a group of counties that over time shifts from not being affected to being affected by the bat die-offs. And I compare how those are changing relative to a group of counties that during this time period is not switching from not being affected to being affected. What I find is that indeed farmers start to increase their use of insecticides on average in the period after bat populations decline by roughly close to 30% increase in the total aggregate amount of insecticides per square kilometer. This is a very large increase. This is not a trivial number to think about in terms of a change in the use of an input, but it is also important to remember that we're not talking about a 1%, 2%, 3% decline in biological pest control. What white noise syndrome effectively did was switch off biological pest control by bats in the counties where it showed up. The declines were so severe in just 2, 3, maybe 5 years, bat populations of different species went completely locally extinct. And at that point, all of that biological pest control was not being substituted by other bat species or by birds. And farmers noticed that potentially they were experiencing heavier pest pressure on their fields and greatly elevated their use of the substitution insecticides.
This is a huge effect. It's happening in some counties in the United States. Can we say something larger about its relevance to society, the use of insecticides?
We've had ecologists say something about how insecticides will tend to substitute for bats, but we've also had a very large literature talking about insecticides, not as a substitute for bats, but as a form of toxic chemical pollution. And it's important to remember that unlike air pollution or other sources of water pollution that are not meant to be toxic, pesticides are toxic compounds by design. So we've had epidemiologists and public health experts raise very big concerns about what are the health implications of using a greater variety of pesticides, using larger quantities of them, having those show up in drinking water, having those getting eroded by air, and having populations breathe in those chemicals. And there's been a non-trivial amount of work documenting negative correlations between pesticide exposure and health. The key problem is that it was hard to interpret them as a causal effect because there could be a lot of other things that would explain why some people live in the proximity of an agricultural field and get exposed to a higher dose of pesticides. What I had in my setting is this sudden, unexpected, very large change in the amount of insecticides being used. And I was then able to see whether there was also a change in some metric that tells us something about public health. In a lot of environmental and health papers, we use infant mortality as a marker of population health because they don't have a long health history that we need to account for. And they're very sensitive. And you can think of them as sort of like a canary in the coal mine. If things start to go bad in the environment, unfortunately, infants might suffer the consequences first. And I use data on infant mortality rates and see that they too increased in the same counties that saw the elevated insecticide use only after white noise syndrome entered those counties and managed to establish itself, and didn't do so in the counties that were yet unaffected by white noise syndrome.
Another very consequential and surprising piece of research you have been able to do is to study the population of vultures in India. What's been happening to India's vulture population?
In the past, they used to be everywhere. Estimates anywhere between 30 to 50 million vultures across the country. There are many photos from the 70s and 80s with vultures just lining the rooftops in different parts of India. They played a really important role in carrying out and removing dead animals from the environment because they're scavengers. So in a country where there are roughly 500 million livestock animals and there are pretty important social norms about the handling of meat, vultures are a key component in the production function of handling the waste product at the end. People would dump dead animals at these animal landfills, and the vultures will show up and clean down a body down to the bone in about 40 minutes.
Wow.
That worked for a long time very well. While this was happening, a pharmaceutical drug with the active ingredient called diclofenac, we might be more familiar under the brand name Voltaren, reached its patent expiration date, and there was a generic approval made in 1993. India has a tremendously strong and potent generic pharmaceutical industry. They started producing versions of that drug. It lowered the price so much that livestock farmers started administering it to their livestock animals to deal with inflammations and fevers, increase productivity, make them more docile to manage, a sort of different benefits to the animals and to the farmers. So far, so good. Mm-hmm. What no one understood at the time, and no one really understood for about a decade, is that when those dead livestock animals ended up in the landfill with residue of diclofenac, and a vulture of a specific genus, the Gyps genus, would eat that dead animal, they would develop kidney failure and die within a matter of weeks. It took about 2 years for one ecologist to start asking questions. I'm noticing about half of the vultures at my study site are dead. Is anyone else noticing that? And a lot of their colleagues said, yes, same is happening here. I thought that was just something idiosyncratic and isolated to my study site. And all of a sudden, everyone noticed that vulture populations were in massive decline. It took, though, until 2004 for a paper to come out in Nature and really establish diclofenac as the cause for that mortality. Unfortunately, by that point, vulture populations have collapsed by over 95%.
Wow. 95% collapse in the vulture population, which is terrible and extraordinary. Can we estimate an impact on the human population as well?
Around the same time as those vulture populations were declining so sharply, many people started voicing complaints about water sources being more polluted because there's more rotting flesh out in the open.
Yes.
It started complaining about there being more feral dogs because a large pack of vultures competes for dead animals with feral dogs and they manage to crowd them out. In the absence of vultures cleaning up the dead bodies, there's a greater food supply for rats and for dogs. And in India, feral dogs are a problem because of animal bites and rabies. And there are these reports of people saying that they're afraid to go out in the street and afraid to let their kids play out on the street because they're worried that they'll get attacked by dogs. What Anand Sudarshan and I did, my co-author from University of Warwick, was try to take this again very seriously and go and obtain the best source of data that we had at a granular spatial level, the district level, at a yearly level as well. And we looked at all-cause mortality because that was the only level of aggregation that was available before and after this collapse of vultures between places that we were able to classify as highly suitable for vultures and less suitable for vultures. What we found is that there was no meaningful difference in how those two groups of districts, highly suitable and not so suitable, were trending in the years before the vultures started to collapse. But in the years after 93 and 94, we started seeing the high suitability districts diverge and see elevated levels of all-cause mortality relative to what was happening in the low vulture suitability districts. And by the year 2000, when we know that vulture populations effectively reached the bottom of the barrel, that they were in their new equilibrium, they were all listed as critically endangered, and we know that they've declined by over 95%, we start seeing this effect saturate and hold steady simply because there was no more scavenging benefit to be lost. It is all eroded away with the decline of vultures. On average, what we find is that all-cause mortality increased by about 4%. And with a country as big as India, that translates to about an additional death toll of 100,000 deaths a year.
With this death toll, then are there policy solutions to this, or is it too late already?
That's a great question. There are things that can be done to try and address this decline of vultures. One is, instead of allowing people to simply throw animals in landfills, you either require them to bury the animals so they're not available to pollute water sources or available as a food source for dogs. You can construct a network of incinerators designed specifically for burning livestock animals. Both of these are going to impose high costs, either large labor costs in terms of burying the animals or high capital costs in terms of setting up a network of incinerators and operating it, generating also air pollution, which will have its own environmental and health impact. But also, one of the greatest benefits of vultures, that they come to where the problem is at. With a network of incinerators, you need to bring the dead animals to the incinerator. Another thing that can be done, and this is happening in India, is try to vaccinate feral dogs against rabies. This is both labor and capital intensive because you need to repeat this year after year. And it's in a way handling the problem kind of like at the end of the pipe. Instead of trying to restore balance in the ecosystem and try to curb the population growth of feral dogs, you're just trying to make that now larger population of feral dogs not as problematic for humans. These are all costly interventions. We've seen some of the latter one in terms of rabies vaccinations, but not so much of the previous two. I think this also highlights a very interesting difference in this study relative to the one on bats, where in the story on the declining bats, the problem mostly arises from the fact that there was a readily available substitute and farmers did exactly what environmental economists predicted they would do. If a natural input declines and there's a readily available human-made substitute, use that, hold production and well-being and utility at somewhat constant levels, and everything should be fine. That holds true just as long as that substitute doesn't cause its own set of problems, which in the case of insecticides, it appears to cause them. In the case of vultures, however, we have all these readily available human-made substitutes or policy interventions. They're prohibitively expensive, so even though they're available to us, we're not using them, which in a way highlights how big and important the value was that vultures were providing to us for free by scavenging on all of those dead animals.
Reading your research makes me realize how little I know about how these ecosystems work. There is some more recent research that you've done into the population of desert locusts and the value of monitoring those populations. Tell me what desert locusts are and why we need to monitor for them.
They're a species of grasshoppers. That's what they would look to us if we just like randomly encounter them on the street. What's unique about them, though, is that they spend most of their lives, or at least most of the time, they live in a solitary state out in the desert in Saharan Africa. That means that each grasshopper is on their side of the desert. They want to keep their distance from the other grasshoppers. I have my space, you have your space, and all is well. All that changes with very heavy and intense rainfall that causes the desert to become green. This is still a desert, so those sharp rainfall events don't persist. That green carpet starts to contract into smaller and smaller green patches. These locust grasshoppers still want to stay in the green patches to eat on at the green shrubbery. But now they're jumping around in an area that gets smaller and smaller, and they're hitting each other. That triggers a hormonal effect that gets them to change both their physical appearance. They go from this like gray to yellow, and their behavior. They stop acting as this solitary grasshopper, and they're now behaving like a locust swarm with a hive mind.
Right.
And they go on this rampage of just eating everything that's on their path. And when they're done, they just jump up, spread their wings, and glide on wings to the next place, land, eat whatever is available there, and keep doing this. They keep laying eggs, and with each generation, as long as the soil has enough moisture, they multiply by a factor of 20. So within just a year, every 2-3 months, you're seeing this increase in locusts by a factor of 20. You very quickly go from a somewhat small swarm to a swarm that covers the land size of about a Manhattan and a half. This poses grave food security concerns to the exposed populations. If we're able to detect the formation of a swarm early enough, we can try different things in terms of trying to disrupt the egg masses, trying to spray insecticides to prevent them from reaching that critical mass of being the size of about a Manhattan, where then it is extremely difficult to keep them managed and under control. But in order to monitor and be in a position where we can do something about them, it requires a lot of coordination between different countries. It requires non-negligible expenditures of sending people out into the desert to monitor and check, especially after heavy rains. And it requires having a functional fleet of planes that are able to spray insecticides. All of these are very costly to maintain and very hard to justify the upkeep during many years in which there is no outbreak. And we tend to see an outbreak happening every decade or two decades now. The most recent one started in 2019, 2020, because we collectively dropped the ball on monitoring locusts in Yemen due to the civil war conditions that were there.
Right.
And the swarm evolved, crossed the Red Sea into Eastern Africa. And at that point, it was just too big to manage quickly enough. And we got these 2-3 years of plague conditions of locust swarm circling around Northern Africa, decimating food crops.
I can understand why in quiet times, monitoring might seem like too high an expense. You've spoken about the impact on the natural environment. Do we know what the impact of a locust swarm is on the human population?
I don't think it takes a lot of imagination to think that if a swarm of locusts shows up and decimates the available food supply, that's going to lead to some negative outcomes on that exposed population. What we do in our study is try to quantify one dimension with the data that's available to us. We look at children and their height as measured in the demographic health surveys. The reason that height is an important metric is because if there was a period of food insecurity around the timing of birth or early on in childhood, that tends to scar children and they don't easily recover from that, even if the food insecurity conditions don't persist in the years after. So we get to look at children and match their timing of birth to whether or not there was a swarm of locusts in the area of the village at the time. And we see these really large declines in height per age, which is a measure of just how potentially stunted you might be. And we see that it's not just a trivial change in their height. We see meaningful increases in the probability of being classified as stunted, which means it's a severely reduced height relative to what your age distribution is. We see these really big increases in that probability that we know are then detrimental to outcomes in adulthood as well.
So given these impacts that you've managed to identify, can we get to some kind of cost benefit for improving the quality of monitoring?
We can. And this is something that we do near the end of the analysis in the paper. Like many papers in this field of development and environment economics, try to talk about what is the benefit to cost ratio, meaning can we quantify the health benefits in some dollar terms and compare how many dollars are we getting for $1 expenditure that we're investing in trying to prevent or manage the problem. I don't want to tie myself here to a specific number because this is an area of the paper that we're putting in a lot of work now, making sure that we're correctly accounting for all of the costs and thinking of all the different ways we can rigorously account for the benefits. But we're clearly seeing that even our most conservative estimates highlight a benefit to cost ratio of about 10 to 1.
10 to 1.
And at times even larger. Mm-hmm. In other words, even our most conservative estimates of the benefits of managing and trying to prevent locust outbreaks appear to be well justified by the benefits that they deliver. The costs are non-negligible when you think about the budgets of these countries and the support that the FAO has to also extend in terms of organizing and coordinating all of these efforts, but the benefits massively outweigh the costs.
In tying all of this together, these themes in your work, in an earlier paper called Balancing Economic and Ecological Goals, you report some very startling figures for how humans are degrading our ecosystems. How fast is this happening compared to the norm before human beings were around?
We know from a variety of studies done in ecology that we always tend to see species leave the global stage, enter the global stage. That's always been a part of the natural world. The key problem now is that species exiting the global stage and becoming extinct appears to be happening at a rate that is 100 times or 1,000 times greater than the normal background levels for that process. The velocity at which extinctions are happening is accumulating to such a degree that ecologists are referring to this as the sixth great mass extinction. By calling it the sixth, it obviously tells you that there were other periods of mass extinctions where very large amounts of species were simply completely wiped out in just a few years. And what ecologists are saying that in the future, when looking at the geological records, this period will look like one of those great mass extinctions as well, because we are driving so many species towards extinction.
If this is being caused by modern human activity, does this lead us to the conclusion that there is a trade-off between growth, economic activity producing growth, and conservation?
I think that the answer is yes. I think that in some cases, there will be some win-win situations where promoting nature-based solutions also delivers meaningful economic benefits. But in a lot of cases, when we think about economic development, it comes at the expense of habitats or environmental conditions that are important for the survival of species. That economic activity has a benefit that we can measure in dollar values. I think it's also important that we understand what we might be risking of losing when we approve of that additional development. There's a bigger position in some circles that we should not try to put these monetary values on nature, with the idea that it's just philosophically wrong to do so. What I tend to argue is that if we don't quantify what these benefits are in some monetary terms, it's not going to be that we are going to implicitly think of them as infinite. We're going to implicitly think of them as zero. And then in every time that we make that comparison between should we allow for additional development and potentially degradation of nature or not, we're always going to say yes, because we have just failed to fully quantify and understand what it is we might be potentially losing as a result. We live in a world of trade-offs. These ideas of how to balance biodiversity losses, ecosystem functioning, and economic development fit right in there.
It's not surprising that biodiversity has its own COP. The UN Biodiversity Conference in 2024 was COP 16. How much attention is given to rigorous research like yours in this policy forum?
I don't have a good answer for it. I think every academic wants to be not just policy relevant, but policy useful, and that policymakers use the work and it helps them with articulating arguments for why a certain policy instrument versus another, or push for certain policies. I know that some of my work in the past on the balance between wildlife trade and a treaty that is meant to protect species from extinction has been used in policy circles to try and get more species protected. And I hope that some of my more recent work on bats and vultures and locusts will also be helpful for policymakers to set a level of conservation expenditures and policy that is more optimal. In other words, that takes into account that we tend to benefit a lot from a functioning natural world as well.
Then let me ask you about outcomes instead of inputs. What did COP16, in your opinion, achieve? What is it not achieving, especially for low middle income countries where you say these problems are particularly acute?
I think we're very far from what we all hope these mechanisms will deliver on. We are still playing catch up in the world of biodiversity and ecosystem functioning to the climate change problem. We've had six IPCC reports. We've had but one IPBES report, which is the equivalent body to IPCC to biodiversity. We've had many more COPs for climate change than we did for biodiversity and ecosystems. With climate change, there's this global pool of greenhouse gases But with biodiversity, you have these different biodiversity hotspots. Mm-hmm. So it's a global problem, but with a lot of local implications as well. We are very far from an outcome out of one of those COPs that delivers on what we need to meaningfully curtail biodiversity losses. But I'm just hoping that it doesn't take us 20, 30, 50 years to catch up to where we need to be to deliver on that outcome.
I think we all hope that as well. Eyal, thank you very much for talking about this today.
Thank you for having me.
There are more references than usual this week, but I can promise you they are all worth reading. First of all, the economic impacts of ecosystem disruptions cost from substituting biological pest control. That was in Science 385, published 2024. The social costs of keystone species collapse, evidence from the decline of vultures in India. That's joint work with Anant Sudarshan. That was published in the American Economic Review, volume 114, number 10, also 2024. The working paper, The Value of Monitoring for Disaster Prevention, The Desert Locust. Many authors for that one. I won't list them all. Also, Balancing Economic and Ecological Goals, joint with Wolfram Schlenker, and that was published in Science 353, and that was in 2016. This has been a Vox Dev Talk, the best way to make sure you don't miss an episode. Subscribe. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org. If you like what you're hearing, please tell someone about us and leave us a review.